Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. And that's the name of this program. Here on LightResistanceRadio.com. Well, lots more news and views for our people. And those are the European founding settler people, the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia, New Zealand, Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you may be listening this morning in the European heartland. Well, just get this through your heads. No matter what happens to a minority, it's your fault. Okay, here's the story of Kelly Fraser. Now, Kelly Fraser is a up-and-coming Canadian pop star. Now, despite her name, she's actually an Eskimo. And this is a write-up from a couple days ago, actually from New Year's Eve. Eskimo pop singer-songwriter Kelly Fraser, who garnered worldwide attention with her Inuktitut, that's an Eskimo language cover of Rihanna's Diamonds, has been seeking help for post-traumatic stress disorder before dying by suicide last week, according to her family. Sorry, she had been seeking. Miss Fraser's mother, Teresa Angu, now, don't ask me. How is her mother's last name different from hers? But okay, let's move along. Mustn't ask too many questions. So her mother, Teresa Angu, and six siblings issued a joint statement that's saying that she died on Christmas Eve. But she took her own life at age 26. She was a reasonably pretty-looking girl. Quote, Kelly suffered from PTSD for many years as a result of childhood traumas, racism, and persistent cyberbullying, the statement said. She was actively seeking help and spoke openly about her personal challenges online and through her journey. I don't get this, but on social media, Ms. Fraser proudly showed off clothing and jewelry by Eskimo designers and promoted other Eskimo musicians and artists. She posted excitedly about traditional foods, caribou, seal eyeballs. You know, I hope you haven't just had supper. Matak, which is apparently is whale skin and blubber. So they give you a plate of that stuff. An oatmeal with akpik berries. But amid the cheery post was also signs that she felt the weight of criticism. I face a ton of lateral violence and criticism and hate, she wrote in December 15th Facebook post. I need a strong support system. Just because I'm well-known doesn't mean I deserve it. Eskimos have among the highest suicide rates in the world. In 2017, the rate was 106 for every 100,000 people. Charlie Angus, NDP MP for Temiskaming James Bay, which is the northern part of the province of Ontario. Let's see, what will Charlie Angus say? Ms. Fraser's death underscores the need for a national suicide prevention strategy. We lose so many young people in my region to suicide, and they are treated as tragedies. Yeah, well, what do you make of this? I mean, honest to goodness, notice that the mother blames that she'd been fighting or dealing with post-traumatic stress syndrome for many years as a result of childhood traumas. We're not told what those were. I could speculate, but I won't. Oh, yes, and racism. And persistent cyberbullying. Now, she's a success. I think we've got to really strike back every time we get accused of racism. No, or I mean, the Canadian society, or I don't know, maybe white society is somehow all to blame for this. But her mother blames cyberbullying and racism. If somebody's criticized, she says she's dealing, or at least Kelly, Fraser said she feels faces a ton of lateral violence and criticism and hate. But wait a second, those are three very different things. I'm not sure I know what lateral violence is. That you mean somebody came up and whacked her on the head or slapped her around? I don't think that's what she means. And criticism and hate. Well, you know, if you're an artist, of course you're sensitive, and I'm sure you're very proud of what you do, and nobody likes criticism. But that goes with the territory. Some will love what you're doing, and some will hate it. And of course, hate. Yeah, you know, this is all just so utter snowflakery. Though the girl, Kelly Fraser, won a Juno Award this past year. For a girl who's 26, she's making quite a career for herself, and not just as in what you might call an ethnic enclave. She was apparently quite good at something, an Eskimo practice called throat singing. But she crossed over into pop. She's in the process of working on her third album. She was crowdsourcing it. She obviously had support. She'd won a Juno, which is Canadian annual Canadian Music Awards. Her mother blames racism and cyberbullying. The fact is, if you're going to be a public figure, you've got to be able to put up with some criticism, and probably nasty criticism. Now, being a privileged minority, being a minority, a racial minority, I would imagine she got a lot of very kind, supportive comments, because that's the way Canadian society is today. But I absolutely revolt at this notion that somehow we are to blame. And you know, that we are to blame culture is doubly mischievous. Number one, because we're not to blame. We didn't do it. It's a false charge. And we shouldn't have to put up with being falsely accused of things. Secondly, it provides a very easy crutch for anything that goes wrong in a minority person's life. It's racism. You know, if they don't graduate from school, it's racism. Or they maybe didn't graduate from school because they didn't go very often. If they don't succeed financially, it must be racism. Or maybe the fact they don't have any job skills or they don't apply themselves or want to work. Anyway, that's mischievous, because instead of encouraging people to get to the bottom of what their problems are, it allows them to fob off any setbacks in their lives as being, it's just because of white racism. Well, it's not. I think we have to fight back against it. Now, I'm very curious about what the trauma is that she has battled PTSD, that's post-traumatic stress syndrome, for many years because of childhood traumas. Okay, well, it all sounds very, very sad, and I'm curious, what trauma? Well, we're not told. It surely wasn't racism, because she grew up in the Arctic, where she would be largely surrounded by other Eskimos. So, okay, then what is it? Well, we're not told. And I must say, I'm not advancing this as the answer, because, frankly, I don't know the answer. But if we're talking about childhood trauma, incest and sexual molestation are major problems among many of Canada's so-called Native people. It's a real problem. Now, was that the childhood trauma? If so, of course, it's something she would have to deal with. But if that is the problem, then let's not muddy the waters or spread the blame by invoking racism. Well, I was listening to NPR, that's National Public Radio. I'm in the mountains of British Columbia right now. And one segment on today's news dealt with the feelings of Hasidic Jews in some suburb of New York City, and how afraid they were. They feel scared of everything. Even a car comes into the neighborhood, they're worried, and they stand out. Well, of course, the men do stand out. They're wearing these 18th century fur hats, sombreros, and they wear these sort of black frock coats, and you know, they have these ringlets around the rear. So I mean, they stick out. Okay, well, there have been a couple of incidents where Jews have been attacked in the past couple of weeks. In Jersey City, a couple of weeks ago, two members of a black group, went into a kosher, I think, delicatessen, and killed three people, knifed three people. This was David Anderson and Francine Graham, and they were members of a group called the Black Hebrew Israelites. Now that in itself is rather interesting. And notice the initial publicity was, the press was absolutely salivating with the idea, whoever did this must be a white supremacist, because they were not caught on the scene, on the spot. They were caught a few hours later. Then it turned out, they're black. So we can't, and they use knives. So they can't blame guns. So the usual gun demands for gun control would seem absurd, even coming from gun-hating liberals. And of course, it was another privileged minority that did this. This is not white supremacists. So, oh, shucks. That's all right. Anyway, in the interview the National NPR did today, there was some talk about, well, where did this all come from? Well, a Jewish father and his wife, whom they interviewed, and their 12-year-old son, the father speculated that it had a lot to do with white supremacists. White supremacists. Do words have any meaning? The two people who did the Jersey City stabbings were David Anderson and Francine Graham. They're both in their 50s, and they're members of the Black Hebrew Israelites. White supremacy? I don't think so. And then, of course, the attack last Saturday in the heavily Jewish Orthodox suburb of Muncie, just outside New York City. A rabbi had a group of people in to celebrate Hanukkah, or lighting one of the Hanukkah candles, and a man, turns out to be black, stormed in with a machete and hacked away, and seriously injured one person. Four others were less seriously injured. Well, okay, white supremacy? No. So anyway, the various efforts to explain this, but, was, were I didn't think very successful, but anyway, on the New Year's Eve, the National Post had a long article about this and said talked about the stabbings in Jersey City by these two members of the Black Hebrew Israelites, and they described this as a hate group that traffics in anti-Semitic tropes. Authorities said they had also posted anti-Semitic and anti-police screeds online. You know, and oh, who wrote all this? Shana Jacobs. Five will get you ten. Shana Jacobs is Jewish. Because the very verbiage used to describe these people, in this case, they're not white supremacists or even whites. They're two Negroes who are members of the Black Hebrew Israelites. But we're told that it's a hate group. Well, are they? I don't know a whole lot about them. I would like to have some facts, not name calling. I believe that I met Black Israelites, or sorry, Black Hebrew Israelites many, many years ago, and if I'm correct, they somehow believe they're one of the lost tribes of Israel. Okay, so but they're called a hate group. Well, not only is that not very nice, I'd like some evidence about this. You see, we're talking about the fake news or the non-news. Okay, and it's a hate group that traffics in anti-Semitic tropes. Now, anytime you hear that word trope, you are listening to anti-free speech Zionist propaganda. What is a trope? Well, I don't mean to say you're not very well educated, but you probably don't know. I didn't know up until a few months ago. Now, you might take a guess, and it would seem to suggest, well, lies. And not exactly. Trope is a very seldom used word in English. And it means a pattern or a general statement. Well, traffic in anti-Semitic tropes. Well, why not say lies if they are indeed lies? Or, you know, give us an example. Why is it we get the accusations, but we never get an example? And anti-police screeds online. Screeds. Well, usually refers to over-the-top, vicious, unreasonable statements. I'm going to see what Google tells us about these folks, these Black Hebrew Israelites, if anything helpful. You see, one of my ongoing objections to the much of the lamestream media is that they are not news; they are editorials. That's what they are. They masquerade as news, telling you the facts. And I come back to what I used to do when I taught journalism. And I said, the key to a good news story, or what you ought to be doing, is to remember that bullet-headed, brush-cutted detective from the 1960s TV detective show called Dragnet. And this was Sergeant Joe Friday. And he was a tough, no-nonsense, humorless L.A. detective. And he would often come upon a woman who'd witnessed the crime, and she's hysterical and her speaking all over the place, and he would try to calm her down and say, "The facts, ma'am, just the facts." You see, and that's what a good news story should provide: the facts. Opinions have a role in radio. I'm an opinion person in TV, in newspapers, but not labeled as news. as opinion, sure. Okay, and too much of the mass media, or the fake news media, simply gives us a blast of very, very slanted opinion. So in the description of this group, and I'll just come back to it again, these are the ones, the members of this group, the black Hebrew Israelites, went into a kosher supermarket in Jersey City and stabbed and killed three Jews. Okay, now they're described, the group is described here as a hate group. Well, okay, let's take a look at, this is not necessarily the final word in these things, but let's take a look at Wikipedia. So this is readily accessible. Black Hebrew Israelites, and they have several other names, but are a group of black Americans who believe they are the descendants of ancient Israelites. To varying degrees, black Hebrew Israelites adhere to the religious beliefs and practices of both Christianity and Judaism. Many choose to identify as Hebrew Israelites or black Hebrews rather than Jews in order to indicate their claimed historic connections. In contrast to black Jews, black Hebrew Israelites are not associated with the mainstream Jewish community and do not meet the standards which are used to identify people as Jewish in the Jewish community. At the end of the 19th century, Frank Cherry and William Saunders Crowdy both claimed that African Americans are descendants from the Hebrews in the Bible. Consequently, black Hebrew groups were formed in the United States during the late 19th and early 20th centuries, from Kansas City to New York. According to the Anti-Defamation League, some but not all sects of the black Hebrew Israelites are outspoken anti-Semites and racists. Oh, really? I don't think they're white supremacists, though. As of December 19th, the Southern Poverty Law Center, which is a wildly biased outfit in Montgomery, Alabama, lists 144 black Hebrew Israelite organizations as black separatist hate groups because of their anti-Semitic and anti-white beliefs. I've got to say that we, even from those descriptions, we don't have a lot of facts. And, but it's a bizarre religion. And, you know, there's just nothing wrong with being bizarre. But instead of giving us a fact, the newspaper write-up gives us this... denunciation. I saw a post on a news story from England about anti-Semitic slogans in a small community outside London, but were, I believe, spray painted on several Jewish shops. And this was a huge incident, and try to get a grip on this. Nobody was hurt. You know, I don't condone for one moment vandalism. It's wrong, but these things also have to be put into perspective. And I'll come back to perspective in a minute. But the vandalism, the spray painting with anti-Jewish slogans. Well, there'd be all sorts of local condemnation, and there's no room for hate, and so on and so on. I noticed in the article, which was from a mainstream British newspaper, that we were told that these anti-Jewish slogans had been. Do you want to know what the next word is? It's a word that means painted. Well, why didn't they just say painted? Or, as I actually believe from the pattern, spray painted. Well, no, but they were daubed. Now, D-A-U-B-E-D. Whenever you hear that word, that is Zionist anti-free speech propaganda. It's like in talk, inside group talk. It isn't even accurate. Daubing is a gesture with a paintbrush that an artist uses. And it roughly means flicking paint on a canvas or layering it. You know, instead of a brush stroke, the paint is sort of flicked on or layered. Now, that does not describe the painting action that would normally be done, especially if somebody's doing it quickly, on a door or a window or a building. You would take your paintbrush and as continuous stroke as possible, write your letters and so on and move on. You wouldn't be flicking paint at it. Well, actually, having taken a look at those pictures, I'm pretty much convinced that they were done with a spray can. I don't know how you would daub with a spray can. Well, why that term? I'm not quite sure, but I've noticed it in almost any description of any public sign or graffiti aimed against Jews. We're informed that somebody, these people, daubed. And I remember this going way back to about 1960, when I was 10 years old. I was very interested in reading. And around that time, suddenly, within a couple of weeks, all sorts of Jewish graveyards across Germany had swastikas painted on the gravestones. They didn't say painted. They said daubed. Well, I was only 10 years old, but I at least figured it meant something to do with painting, you know what I mean? But it always struck me as an odd word, and I don't ever remember hearing that word again, except always with any painting or spray painting of signs critical of Jews. And then we're always told these signs were daubed. Okay. It's almost like an in sort of language. And then years later, I did hear the word daubed used very, very occasionally as describing a painting technique. And I've seen that term used over the years in just this context, and almost only this context. So keep an eye out for that. Oh, yes. Well, let's see. Back to the incident about New York City. Well, the governor wanted to declare a state of emergency. He wanted to declare it a act of terrorism. Now, this is the attack on the rabbis. Hanukkah candle lighting, an act of domestic terrorism. Well, it sounds to me, and his only accused, own family said he was dealing with mental problems, and that would seem probably a pretty fair conclusion. But domestic terrorism, well, for it to be terrorism, it has to be, of course, violent. Well, that was violent. And it has to be in the pursuit of, usually it would be a political goal, but it could be ideological or even religious. But we're not told, apparently the fellow didn't say anything, except I think he said to one Jew who was fleeing that he was going to get him or something like that, but we're not actually given any. In fact, the police may not know, what his motives were. And not to defend this fellow for a second, I'm not. But before we slap that very loaded and specific word terrorism on him. It might be useful to know, exactly what his motives were. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side. I mean, now that's a very interesting write-up by a Canadian member of Parliament who's gone public about a rather sordid incident that happened under the now resigned Conservative Party leader, Andrew Scheer. And this MP's name is Scott Reed. And he's the MP for Lanark, Frontenac, and Kingston. And he's one of the longest serving Conservative members of Parliament. And he said that he was booted out of the shadow cabinet when he decided, having polled his constituents, he decided to vote for the legalization of marijuana. Now, I must say, on a personal basis, I am somewhat divided on the issue. As a libertarian, I don't like the state telling you what you can do. I think an adult, or at least adults, should be able to decide what they're going to put in their lungs and so on. I think, frankly, efforts over the years to stop the use of marijuana have been singular failures. They have cost us a fortune. And I'm not sure that we really have achieved much. Do I approve of marijuana? No, on a personal basis, I don't. I do not smoke it. I do not like it. I don't agree with it. But that, anyway. So, no, whether or not I agree with Scott Reed or not isn't important. But what was his procedure? Well, he took a poll of his constituents. And he found that by a reasonable margin, not a huge one, but a reasonable margin, they approved of the legalization of marijuana. Well, I think it seems to me that is what a member of Parliament ought to do. He ought to find out what his constituents want, and then try to implement it, deliver it. If that's what they believe, then that's what they should get. Well, anyway, when it became known that he was going to do that, he was threatened, and eventually he was kicked out of the shadow cabinet. And he says, although he found his constituents 55-45 supportive of the legalization, he said none of this mattered to the leader, who was Andrew Scheer at the time. I was summoned to his office, informed by him that the constituency referendum instrument was worthless, and was presented with a choice between voting against Bill C-49, that'd be voting against legalization of marijuana, resigning my post as democracy critic, or being sacked. In other words, you're out. Now, this is one of the reasons why the Canadian representative government is struggling so desperately these days. Because members of Parliament are constantly being whipped, or that's an old technical term, but are being beaten in to follow the party line, instead of what ought to be, and that is with the emphasis on representing their constituents. That's what the Member of Parliament's prime role is. Not to applaud every time the party leader gets up in the House of Commons and says something. To be something more than just a trained seal clapping its flippers together on command. But should thoughtfully, actively represent the views of the of his constituents. And it is because for far too long that has not happened that we have the mess we're in today, where we have national policies that do not reflect the will of people, and particularly our catastrophic immigration policies. And this is actually a very thoughtful article that Scott Reed wrote, and he concludes it by saying, "Perhaps I really am a wild-eyed libertarian dreamer. In the crazy Leninist world of Canada's leader-centric parliamentary politics, maybe the only proper role for any MP, other than the one who is being selected as leader, is to be silent and obedient. But I'm hoping that each of the candidates running to be the next leader of the Conservative Party will decide otherwise and will pledge to drag our parliamentary wing back into the situation, from the situation to which it's followed. And I kind of like that that comment. In the crazy Leninist world of Canada's leader-centric parliamentary politics, where you are under, where an MP is under tremendous pressure to mindlessly support the party leader. I have always had a certain reserve about what I might would call the Führer principle, which means that we've got to find the right leader and put all our hopes and loyalty to him, and somehow we will be saved. I think it's more complicated than that. yes, much can be done by a good leader, no doubt about it. But we need more than just one voice and mindless support of that leader. In fact, to restore confidence in our system, we need people to be able to believe that their voices, their concerns will be heard. And the concerns and opinions of the people in Scott Reed's riding might not be the same as the concerns of the people in, let's say, Andrew Scheer's rural Saskatchewan riding. They might not be the same. And that's okay. If we restore the role of the member of parliament as a voice and representative for his area, his people, I think there would be a lot more national support and confidence in our system. And there isn't. And this is not unique, unfortunately, to the Conservative Party. In fact, the Liberal Party is even more ruthless. You cannot oppose abortion and be a Liberal member of Parliament. Well, okay, you might have your private view, but you may not speak against it. You may not vote. You may not vote against abortion or speak against it. You are, in other words, a moral eunuch, unless you happen to believe in the unrestricted right of a woman to snuff out the life of her unborn child right up to the moment that its little head pops out of the womb. A lot of liberals don't agree with that, or at least have traditionally not agreed with that. But today they must, or they simply can't be a Liberal member of Parliament, or run for Parliament for the Liberal Party. It's that totalitarian. And I think Scott Reed is very much onto something. We're going to restore real representative democracy. We have to restore the role of the member of Parliament. Well, I'm going to take my musical break right now. I'm going to play a duet by...
If you have arthritis, you should be eating more of
Playing a duet by George Jones and Merle Haggard, and it's called...
I've just got to say something here.
The way I am.
I've got to say what a thrill this is to be on stage at the Old Ryman with Merle Haggard. My favorite singer since Hank Williams Sr. And I mean with all my heart. But the main thing, we're on stage tonight for real country. Wish I was down on some I'm just that ain't like me. Well, I just dream, keep on being the way I am. Here I am, out in my shadow. Here I am, reality. I can almost see the father's dance. So I just pray.
What are we going to do now? Can you leave that and got that key? We didn't rehearse it.
We didn't rehearse what?
Yesterday, why?
Yesterday, why? We're aging with time. Not yesterday's wine. Darling, you must.
little medley of a Hank Williams song. If you hear one you like, you tell me about it, okay? I tried so hard, my dear, to show that you're my every dream. Yet you're a pretty thing I do. It's just some evil scheme. The more I learn to care for you, the more we drift apart. Why can't I free your doubtful mind and melt your cold, cold heart? Language they spoke, that somebody didn't know this next song of Hank Williams.
Here's the song that made his name famous all around our world. Songs unless we did the first one that he ever put on record. Y'all know what the first song he ever put out was? It goes like this. Came in last night at half past ten, not thinking of mine, she wouldn't let me in, so move it on.
Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Back with you again tomorrow, same time, midnight Eastern time. The shows are meeting in the morning and 4 in the afternoon. All those are Eastern Standard Time. And I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada. I think we are going to have a little bit of a problem here. Just give me a sec here. Maple Leaf Forever. This is the Canada's real national anthem. This is the Maple Leaf Forever. And love this old timey song. So much more descriptive of Canada the way it is.